Hello, and thank you for tuning into our podcast series on ethics, COVID-19 in Africa. I'm Joe Ali, Assistant Director for Global Programs in the Johns Hopkins Berman Institute of Bioethics, as well as Assistant Professor in the Department of International Health in the School of Public Health. The goal of this Ethics, COVID-19 in Africa podcast series is to explore, from an African perspective, the ethical challenges facing governments, institutions, researchers, clinicians, and members of the public as we collectively manage the COVID-19 pandemic. So today's podcast, we're going to explore the sort of public health and clinical response to the COVID-19 pandemic from the perspective of a colleague who I'll introduce shortly, who is a clinician and public health practitioner and researcher in Ethiopia. So I'll go ahead and introduce our guest today. We have Dr. Adamu Adesiye from Addis Ababa University. He's an associate professor in the College of Health Sciences in the School of Public Health in the Epidemiology Department. He coordinates the Masters of Field Epidemiology Training program. Is a ch the chair of the IRB, the Institutional Review Board that oversees research within the university at Addis Ababa University, and is one of the first individuals actually in Ethiopia to have completed a PhD in bioethics, which he completed in the UK. He's been actively involved with a number of different organizations across Ethiopia to support enhancement of clinical and public health research, as well as the oversight of those activities at the national level and within the institution. He's a member of the executive committee for the Ethiopian Medical Association and has led a number of other research projects in bioethics and public health over the past several years. So maybe I'll stop there and introducing our guest, Dr. Adesiye, and maybe jump right in with a couple of questions for you, Adam. So
Yes, sure.
thanks. So today we're focusing on a couple of areas, as I mentioned, both the sort of population level disease control measures that have been instituted in Ethiopia, as well as sort of some of the issues at the clinical level. And I think maybe we can start with the population level challenges that have in sort of response and then as well as the ethical challenges that are ensuing. So let me just start by asking what have been some of the disease control measures that have been introduced in Ethiopia at the population level?
Thank you, Joe.
Sure.
It's really my pleasure to be part of this podcast. And as you said, we are also learning in the process. So COVID-19 is a challenge. At the same time, we are also learning from the experiences we garner in the response and in the preparedness. So in Ethiopia, the first case was reported in March 13. So it's exactly 2 months yesterday. So we are in the ninth week now. And so the number has been gradually increasing, even though we haven't reached to the stage of sustained community transmission yet officially, but the number has been gradually increasing. In the past few weeks, actually, the number of reports has dramatically increased somehow, but there is an up and down to the number. And since the beginning of the year, the Ministry of Health has established a task force to organize a national response, and accordingly, some measures were instituted in terms of early screening, early case detection, and I mean, actually, this part was initially instituted at the points of national immigration, at the airport, at the international airports in Addis, with a screening of those traveling into the country. Later on, this was followed up by case detection with a case definition at the health facilities, and then lab testing of suspected individuals. So as you know, in the COVID-19, one of the important pillars of the public health response is identifying cases and contact tracing, you know, tracing of the contacts of those cases, then isolating the cases, and then also doing testing as needed of those contacts. So that strategy is called containment. So so that mode was activated early on, and is we are still doing that. So eventually, the testing capacity also has increased. So you know, I mean, at the beginning, we didn't have the testing capacity in the country. We're sending samples to South Africa, but soon after, the testing started in the National Public Health Institute, and now we have over 20 testing centers all over the country. We also have, well, this might be a little bit of a clinical aspect, but we have dedicated health facilities now in case if we have severe cases. But at the moment, all identified and confirmed cases are referred to those centers to stay for the duration they will be observed. So this is more related to case detection and the follow-up. Apart from that, in the general public, we have important awareness raising measures to aware the general public about what COVID is and what everyone can do and should do at individual level, but also at community level and at institutional levels. So this included hand hygiene and hygiene in general, but like hand washing was promoted and practiced quite well, I would say. That's one. So washing, hand washing facilities are now provided in almost all government facilities, public and private facilities. If you enter, then there is a hand washing facility available, and everyone entering into the premises is requested to wash their hands. And there will be sanitizers as well in some offices. And no shaking of hands, that's now, it's a no-no thing. Hygiene is being promoted, and so that's one public health intervention. The other is keeping your distance. This is called the physical distance. So, I mean, in the early days, the term social distancing was used, and but it had negative connotations, like people tried isolating themselves and not associating themselves with others socially. So while being socially connected is actually what we need more in this period. So this is replaced by physical distancing. So we emphasize on social connectedness and solidarity, but keeping our physical distance of 2 meters. So this is promoted in public spaces, especially when you wait for your transportation and so on. So this is another public health measure being instituted. The other was a stay at home request. I think a week after we had a report of cases in the country, all schools were closed. So this was to, again, so that the kids would stay at home and also the crowding in the public health transportation system also will be reduced and so on. So staying at home was promoted by initially schools, then all other public and private workers who it's for whom it's not mandatory to go to offices were staying at home. Either they will take leave or they work from home. So that was another public health measure. And recently also this mask covering your mouth and nose with a mask or some clothing is promoted, and now is it's becoming almost a universal requirement. Another one related to distancing goes also in the buses and in the minibuses, you know, the public facilities, which Joe, when you were in Addis, you might have seen them. They were quite packed. Now it was made a requirement that you occupy like half of the seats would be occupied, but to compensate for that, you would pay double a price. Things like that were also instituted. So these were some of the public health measures in place, maybe quite similar to other countries.
Yeah, I was going to say it does sound quite similar to many other countries, but I imagine and suspect that there are probably some unique particularities about how they were received in Ethiopia, and that is, as we know, Ethiopia is a very large country with 100 million people, I believe. I last checked, we looked today, it was sort of 272 cases, which is quite remarkable, and maybe some lessons to learn there about the disease and transmission. I wonder, you know, you mentioned hand washing and school closures and wearing masks, physical distancing, and other sort of measures that have been instituted. Were there any sort of sociocultural aspects or behavioral sort of ways in which people were behaving that there was something that was noted in your own observations in Ethiopia in terms of how it was received or how easy it was to physically distance or to not go to work or to wear masks, although perhaps face coverage was more of a normal thing, and maybe hand washing is more familiar to many Ethiopians. I don't know, but it would be interesting to hear from your perspective how those were received.
Yes, so exactly, Joe. So I would say like the recommendations were out of necessity well received, but they were not without challenge. As most African countries, the social cohesion in Ethiopia is so strong, and it's very normal to stay close to like your friend and physically, shaking is like you shake hands several times whenever you meet your friends, and hugging, all those are very common in the family, in the social circle. So touching is part of the, it's part of the culture, I would say. And we share a lot in the family. We share. We have, it's a country with limited resources, so there is a lot of overcrowding and crowding in the houses. The average family size is about 5, and you could share maybe a bedroom with your siblings, and so on. So it's just to mention that even though you are convinced that distancing is important, but sometimes you don't have options, so you still have to continue using the same resources you had. And hand washing facilities are not optimum, as you rightly said. So it's not without challenge, as you rightly said.
I imagine, especially on sort of the economic side of things too, for individuals to to not be going into work, are they still managing to receive pay and those sorts of things, or is it what's the situation?
Yes, if you are employed, if you are formally employed, and if you had a contract, then you still can claim for your payments. And as part of the state of emergency declaration made by the state, it was forbidden actually to lay off any of your workers in this period of time. And also, if you are renting a house, it is forbidden to take any measure against the house owners. The landlords cannot take any measures, and they have to either reduce the prices or, you know, all this were made in the declaration. But the problem is if you are not formally employed. So we have several of those. I mean, in Addis, maybe close to between a quarter to half a million of the residents, they earn on daily basis. They go out each day to collect some payment. So that's a challenge. So no one is there to insure anything for them. The state actually was trying to organize some support for such individuals, some feeding centers and so on, but it was in no way optimum. So that's the and you can't really restrict them from going out. So that's also another economic challenge which we faced.
All right, so we're actually now joined by another guest and colleague, a regular to this podcast series, if you can call it that after having recorded one. But our colleague, Dr. Paulina Tindana, has just joined from Ghana. Paulina, as she was introduced during our last series, is a senior lecturer in bioethicists at the University of Ghana School of Public Health. Before joining the School of Public Health and University in 2018, she was the Deputy Chief Health Research Officer at the Navrongo Health Research Center in Ghana, which is in the north. And she's conducted over 20 years of social science research and supported research ethics review processes and systems and capacity development across Africa and specifically in Ghana. And a lot of her work focuses on community engagement in relation to research and other activities. So I think this conversation we're having about community sort of level measures that have been put into effect in order to help control the spread of the virus, something that I'm sure, Paulina, you've thought quite a bit about in Ghana and sort of have probably been monitoring closely in terms of how the community has been receiving some of these countermeasures. So be eager to hear from you, Paulina, about what has been introduced in Ghana. We've already heard from Adamu about how there's been increased attention in policy that's been directed towards having everyone wash hands when they enter facilities related to the sort of physical distancing efforts in order to keep individuals apart, at least I think 2 meters apart is usually the norm, it seems. And then other kind of measures that have been put into effect, like school closures and the like. And covering masking faces, one's face has been instituted, it sounds, in Ethiopia of recent. So be eager to hear if it's the same in Ghana or if there are other things that have been put into effect recently.
Okay, so thank you very much, Joe. It's a pleasure to be back contribute to this podcast series. And so to just talk a little bit about the measures that have been put in place in Ghana in response to COVID-19. So we reported our first 2 cases about 2 months ago on the 12th of March. And following those first cases, the government of Ghana announced certain measures. In fact, one was placing a ban on public gatherings. So all schools, churches, mosques, and restaurants and bars and some specific shops were also closed during that period. the idea was to try and contain the spread, again, because it wasn't clear to us whether there was already community spread as at that time, although the first few cases were actually imported from what we were told. Most of the first few cases were imported. So the government put in place those measures to make sure that at least the cases were quickly identified and isolated, and then contact tracing, enhanced contact tracing actually started. And then a week later, the government closed our borders, so no flights were coming in. And one interesting thing that was done was to, for the last flights that arrived in the country, the government mandatorily quarantined all passengers. Because the early cases were actually imported, one measure was to make sure that those who were coming in were mandatorily quarantined and tested, and those who tested positive were isolated. And so the quarantine took about two weeks, so they had 14 days of mandatory quarantine, and then they were isolated, and the rest were allowed to go back home. And I think the figures that came up from those mandatory quarantines that were done actually highlighted the fact that majority of the cases were actually imported. So it was important for the government to continue to put in place those measures to close our borders to ensure that no new cases were being introduced into the country. And it became clear that because the border closure happened a week after the first two cases were reported, it was likely that some cases had actually gotten into the country and were not picked up, because as at that time, there was no measure to quarantine all travelers. And so what the government did was to do what we call the three-week partial lockdown in selected places, like in the Greater Accra region and then the Greater Kumasi area. Those are the two big cities in the country and that had reported cases. So the government did a partial lockdown. And so you were not, you could only go out to buy essentials. So all schools remained closed, shops remained closed, apart from shops that were selling essentials like food, water, and all that. And again, increasingly, the government continued to emphasize on social distancing protocols and also personal hygiene, like hand washing, and then continue to try and build the necessary capacity to enhance our testing capabilities as well. Because as at the time we started, it was only two testing centers that were actively involved in testing samples. So increasingly it became obvious that it was important to extend it to other centers as well. And it's also to at least decentralize it in a way that would allow cases to be picked up as quickly as possible. The government also instituted what they refer to as stimulus packages. And so all health workers in the country were given tax reliefs for 3 months, covering the months of April, May, and June. And then those who are at the front line, health workers at the full, were classified as those who are at the front line, were given 50% salary allowance. And I remember this created a whole discussion in the media about how you define someone as a frontliner. And then beyond the packages that were given to health workers, I think the government also recognized the fact that many citizens had actually lost their jobs. And of course, that was also presenting some hardships to many, many citizens as well. So what the government did was to provide water free water and then subsidize on electricity for all citizens of the country. This is now being implemented, and I think it's for some of us have enjoyed those subsidies, especially with water and electricity, and I believe that throughout the country, people quite appreciate these efforts. But having said that, I think one of the challenges that currently we face is how to ensure that physical social distancing protocols are observed. And I listened briefly to what Adamu was saying, and I think it cuts across many, many countries, that the experience of trying to get people to social distance, especially in communities where we are socially connected, and a lot of our activities are done within a social environment. Although government has tried to limit, you know, social gatherings like funerals, reducing the numbers that people that often attend funerals to 25. When it comes to commercial activities, particularly in marketplaces, it's been a big challenge to actually ensure that people follow these protocols. In the past 2 weeks, the government has insisted on wearing of masks as mandatory. And that has also become quite a big challenge. Of course, it has always been one whether people can have access to these masks or not. And then also when they have the masks, how they wear it, whether they wear it well or not. And then even the percentage of citizens who actually wear these masks. If you go out into the street now, you would realize that not many people are actually wearing these masks. And I think that has become a big challenge in terms of helping to stop the spread of the virus within the country. And yeah. So increasingly, the police have come in to try and enforce these measures. There have been a few cases where people have felt that their rights have been abused by the police and military, and people have come out to condemn those acts, and those who have been identified to have violated citizens' rights have been actually brought to book. So we are seeing less of those aggressive measures from the police and the military, and more of trying to encourage people to do the right thing, and then also using legal means to arrest and prosecute those who violate these directives. Yeah. It's a bit challenging. I mean, when it comes to, although we often have periodic updates from the Ministry of Health and the Ghana Health Service almost every week in collaboration with the Ministry of Information, trying to update the country on the number of cases and how the disease is spreading. It's been a bit confusing in terms of how these numbers are increasing. At one point, we were told that most of the numbers were based on the fact that we are doing more testing and that it doesn't necessarily translate into an increase in new infections. But that doesn't seem to reflect in the numbers that we currently have. So you can imagine that when we first had our first two cases, March 12th, as of today, 14th May, we have 5,530 cases with 22 deaths and then just 674 recoveries. So there are concerns that it's possible that the numbers are likely to go up if we do more testing, especially if we do more mass testing. But there's also some encouragement that the death toll is not as high as we see in other countries. So of the 530, just 24 deaths have been reported. And all these, we are told, had underlying conditions. So it sort of gives some hope that the situation is not as bad as as we see in other countries. But the other challenge is also that the recovery rate is quite low because we just have only 674 recoveries. So which means that we have over 4,000 active cases within the country, and that is quite problematic.
Yeah, it's quite difficult to know, given issues of community spread, issues of pre-symptomatic or asymptomatic. The level, the quite high level of sort of mild and cases and or milder or asymptomatic cases. Some have reported that to be as high as 80% of cases. So it is quite striking, though, I think, that we see only 272 confirmed cases in Ethiopia, again, with a population of over 100 million people. 5,500, I think you said, confirmed cases in Ghana today, with a population of about 30 million. So relative per capita, at least in terms of documented confirmed cases, more it seems in Ghana at the moment. I just wonder, especially in Ethiopia, where you see such sort of relative low numbers, how that translates into kind of community level beliefs. Globally, we've seen a number of sort of rumors and misperceptions and things spreading, but in some cases, the data suggests things that the communities, members of the public may interpret those data in a particular way that that maybe is aligned with reality and could affect behavior. So interested sort of how all of this translates into the community level in terms of beliefs and attitudes and perceptions. So I don't know if maybe Adamu, if you want to share a little bit on that.
Great. Thanks, Joe. And thank you, Paulina. It was really nice to get first-hand updates from Ghana. Coming back to our situation. So while Ghana is having over 5,000 cases, ours is still 272 as of today. So the number of reports we get each day is also very erratic. There are days when we have one or two cases, and there are other days when you have 20 or more cases. For example, yesterday we had a report of two cases. Today is nine, and so on. So interestingly, there is a lot of the public pays attention to the daily reports of cases and want to know how many are reported that day. And on days when low number of cases are reported, then you could see on the streets how many people are on the streets and how they are behaving. And when on a day when we had the highest number, I think that was 31, was reported there was no one on the streets that day, that afternoon and the day after. And when the first days was reported, we have 5 days so far, again you see the reaction of the public on the streets. So it seems somehow the public, at least in Addis, is reactive to what's being reported on day-to-day basis, which shouldn't have been the case. Maybe one thing we might need to do at a higher government level is maybe to give some message together with the numbers which are being daily reported. The other issue is there was also at some point a question, people were questioning, is it true that we have only few cases? Or are you hiding something? The people were asking if for some political reasons or so, officials are not telling the truth. But I think, as you know, it's difficult to hide anything at this. Everything is connected and so on. And also, at least we know from health facilities if there were severe cases and so on. So that's not. But the public was asking, is it true or so? But when there was a low report of cases in a sustained manner, then some started maybe thinking, maybe corona is no more there. Maybe either it's not our problem or maybe we're somehow protected. Just to mention that Ethiopian Airlines continued to fly until today. There is no, it hasn't stopped. Wherever the routes are open. The Ethiopian Airlines is flying. I think it's flying to DC still, and also is flying to China. It stopped whenever those cities were closed. So this is a very strange policy. Some were trying to question this approach, but despite this, somehow the number of cases is still low. So some were thinking maybe there is no corona, and maybe there is some local factors. Maybe it's the traditional medicine, or maybe the spices, or maybe the altitude.
Yeah, it must be the altitude. You know,
or the altitude, yeah. So, or maybe the BCG vaccine. Yeah. And even some thought maybe it has already happened and it has gone. So we have gone out of the unknowingly. It might have a mild form of the outbreak might have happened and we have survived it. So there are lots of theories to be investigated and proven.
Yeah.
But yeah, so this is where we are.
And Paulina, have you seen any sort of predominant sort of beliefs within communities about coronavirus?
Yes, there's quite a lot of misinformation, and that has become a big problem. So a lot of the information is being shared through social media. And so you find that anyone who has access to any information, people are sort of sharing their own views about what they think is happening. And they're sharing it around, and then some media houses to have become like the focal, medium for disseminating information around on COVID-19. There has been a good attempt, I think, effort by most media houses to bring in experts, mainly scientists and health workers, to speak to the issues and try to clarify any misconceptions that are going on within the community. But if you go into town, you would, and then also some of the feedback we've got from the community is that most people still, don't really understand the risks. So in fact, this communication remains quite a big problem. People think, well, this is one of the viruses that we would overcome. And for others too, it is not as if they don't believe that the disease exists or that we are they could easily be exposed to the virus, but they have no option. So I remember when this discussions around these stay at home messages were being encouraged around the country, it was quite difficult because, and I'm sure Adamo also mentioned that, quite a number of people live on daily wages. So they can't, asking people to stay at home would also affect their survival. They can only put food to table if they are able to go out and earn a living. Some do jobs that we refer to as by day jobs, where they can only go out, work on something, at a construction site, and then earn a daily wage to be able to care for their family. And the government tried, and then I must say that apart from the efforts that are being made by the government, COVID-19 has actually brought out the best in us as humans. And I've seen quite a number of people coming out to support the vulnerable in the community. Quite a number of organizations have come out to develop messages that they are sharing with family members and also communities that they are in touch with. And again, because of the recognition that there's quite a number of misconceptions about the disease, and then the linkage even to the fact that it came from China, and then even within the academic community discussions around some of these conspiracy theories that you hear about the role of Gates, you know, Foundation in this, and the role of the West in this fight and all that. I think creates a lot of, it highlights the increasingly mistrust that we have around vaccines. And that's something that we've been trying to see how best to address them. And so I must say that despite the fact that some efforts have been made to address misconceptions and rumors about the disease, there's still quite a lot of work to be done. One, in trying to make sure that people really understand their risk to exposure when it comes to COVID-19. And I don't think we are doing a good job with that in terms of breaking down the science in a way that would allow lay people to appreciate their exposure to these risks.
Yeah, thank you, Paulina. I want to wrap us up a bit for this podcast, and maybe I'll just ask a question that I think relates to what you were just saying, Paulina. You know, I think Ghana in particular and Ethiopia certainly no strangers to disease outbreaks, infectious disease outbreaks of various sorts. As we discussed on the last podcast, you know, in Ghana in particular, having to navigate the Ebola outbreak, recent one in 2014 and 2015, and a number of other communicable diseases that are sort of fairly common in your region in West Africa. And so I guess I'm wondering if you think there's anything different about, you know, COVID-19 in terms of either the sort of effect it's having on society within your countries, or maybe even more globally, sort of building again on what you were just saying, Paulina, about there seems to be sort of movements towards solidarity here that I don't know if that's commonly seen with other disease outbreaks and epidemics regionally, but just would you be eager to hear your reflections, both of you, on that?
May I start?
Yes, please.
Yeah. Thank you. Yes, I think what makes maybe COVID special to other outbreaks is that there's a lot which we don't know, and to that effect, the extent to which very advanced countries are affected, I think drastically affected, starting from China, Europe, America, were, you know, severely affected, and which is different from the other outbreaks. I mean, the other outbreaks were limited to the countries mostly, and then usually Europe or America wouldn't be severely affected, I mean, at least from what we know recently. So I think that led to the thinking that if those rich countries were not able to contain such an epidemic, then Africa is going it was actually considered as a question of existence at some point. So I think that's why the concern not so much accentuated, and then when this was matched by not much on the ground, I think it opened a room for lots of speculations and rumors. So that's what I see in a way. And the other thing is the measures we took when we had the few cases reported first were all the measures from other countries, and in Ethiopia we didn't take time to contextualize whether this is appropriate in our context, and we didn't discuss with the community. So that's also another, it's a global response, and we're trying to implement this locally. So the tension between the global and the local is another issue reflected there.
Thanks, Adamu. Paulina, do you want to share any thoughts on this?
Yeah, so just to build on what Adamu has said, of course, most of our countries have been exposed to epidemics before. And I can just relate to the recent Ebola epidemic, although Ghana didn't record any cases. We know we were quite close to many countries that have reported cases. And some of the measures we took then are a bit similar to what we are taking now, but not to the scale that we are experiencing now. So during Ebola, we also closed our borders only to flights from countries that had reported cases. And in fact, that is what also informed the earlier measures that were put in place, trying to limit travelers from China and Italy. And it's interesting that my last international trip was actually to Ethiopia, and I came back on the 7th, and one of the questions, I saw the difference between the issue, the discussions or the processes I went through in Addis Ababa, going through the airport, and also in Ghana. In Addis Ababa, I wasn't asked so many questions about my travel history. But when I got back to Ghana, my temperature was taken then. This was just on the 7th before the first cases were reported. And then I was also asked to fill a questionnaire, which included talking and reporting on it, whether I had any symptoms, whether I had been to China and then to Italy. So as of the 7th, Italy and China were regarded as the epicenter. So anyone traveling from those countries had to actually report that travel history, and that could also inform measures that were putting in place then. And so, of course, we have been exposed to these epidemics before. We have even been exposed to even cholera outbreaks that have also informed campaign messages around washing of hands and personal hygiene and all that. But we haven't, I mean, of since I was born, I mean, we haven't experienced the scale that we are experiencing now, where almost everything is shut, where schools are closed, where churches where people go for refuge are also closed, where you feel frightened when you go out because you don't know who you would encounter. Again, because some of the messages are around the fact that the virus can stay on surfaces for a long time. Wearing of masks. This is the first time I am actually seeing wearing of masks as mandatory for a disease outbreak like this. So it's quite worrying. Again, when this whole issue started, I remember some of the rumors were the fact that, well, it's not an African disease. And again, because most of the cases were in China, in Europe. And then there were also rumors about the fact that because of the weather in Africa, the virus would not survive, you know, when it gets to Africa. So I think that people were quite a bit complacent in terms of early measures that were put in place. And increasingly, as the case go up, I think people are becoming more aware that, look, it's not a disease that can withstand, you know, the heat in Ghana or in the heat in any African country, and that we need to take this seriously. The challenge has always been how, you know, you balance, you know, these public health measures with the economic impact that it has on livelihoods. Yes, people want to stay at home, because that's the safest. If you stay at home, that is when you can't be exposed to the virus. But for many citizens, and that is not an option. Staying at home is not an option, because they need to go out. They need to go out and earn a living. And so, increasingly, I think that's what has been informing the government's measures, trying to enforce these public health measures, but also recognizing that it's important for people to be able to go out and earn a living. And so that's why now there's no lockdown in the country now, and people can go out, but they are expected to wear masks to protect themselves. But despite the fact that some can go out, you can imagine what that means for families, you know, where now schools are closed, so children are at home. And how do you balance between taking care of children at home, going out to work, you know, to earn a living and support the family that you have at home? And so that has been one of the biggest challenges. In terms of support, as I mentioned earlier, we've seen a number of individuals and corporate organizations coming out to support, especially the vulnerable. And we've also seen innovation within the country. We've seen a number of individuals and organizations also coming out to offer to produce PPEs. And then masks. So there's a lot of innovation going on where tailors are coming out with different models of masks that are being made available. Hand sanitizers are also being produced locally. Of course, we haven't reached a stage where ventilators are being produced locally, but we've seen a number of universities coming out to indicate that they have samples that they are working on, and given the opportunity and support, they would be able to produce this in large quantities to be able to support the measure. So I must say that all in all, yes, there has been a lot of positive things coming out of COVID, despite the fears and anxieties that are going on, but there's still a long way for us to go. And the challenge is, if the numbers keep increasing and the rate they are increasing, then it will create a lot of challenges, both in terms of how long, you know, because of the uncertainties. Now we don't know how long this virus is going to linger on. How long are schools to continue to close? Some universities like mine have moved classes online. So we are teaching online and conducting exam online. But not all students, all universities are doing that. So there's a lot of uncertainties. When will students graduate? When will students move, you know, to the next class? Because we are now in the third term. And so there's this fear of unknown, you know, that is creating more of the anxieties. And I think gradually we should be able to, again, going back to the point I made earlier about the spirit of solidarity that is going on within the country and everyone trying to do their bit in this fight and not waiting only on the government to do everything.
Yeah, thank you very much to you both. I think that feeling of unknown certainly exists globally. Agree with you. It seems to be somewhat of a unique consideration here, and also the fact that this is a pandemic and affecting everyone. And as we discussed, I think some more than others in terms of both the disease as well as the response mechanisms. So, thank you both, Paulina and Adamu, again for joining today. I think maybe on our next podcast, we'll have a bit more time to discuss some of the issues that are arising within health facilities and at the health systems level. And we look forward to that conversation. So thank you again.
Thank you, Joe.
Thank you, Joe. Thank you.
Thanks, yeah. Thank you,
Adamu, and stay safe.
Thanks.
Yeah, the same to you. Take care. Bye.